You're listening to On Subrogation, the litigation podcast about how to recover your damages from the people who caused them. We are your hosts. I'm Rebecca Wright.
And I'm Steve Alsop, and we are both experienced civil litigators and partners at Rathbone Group.
If you have questions or comments during our podcast, please email us at podcast@rathbonegroup.com.
Or you can visit us at our website, rathbonegroup.com.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast. Today we're talking about tree falling cases, which is a topic that will most likely impact every state in the United States, every jurisdiction.
Everyone that has trees, anyway.
All the places that have trees, which I believe is everywhere. So the topic is basically, what is the liability if a tree falls from one property onto another property or onto a place and causes damage to someone else? So if a tree falls from one property and hits an adjacent property, building or structure and causes damage, if it hits a person and causes medical damage, or if a tree falls across a road or onto a car and causes damage. That is the topic, and whether or not you can recover your damages from the person who owns the tree.
And you know, I gotta tell you, Steve, before I started doing this job, I did not realize how often trees fall onto moving cars. I would have thought that that was pretty rare and that the chances were slim, but actually, it happens more often than you'd think.
Conceptually, it doesn't seem like it's possible that there's so many trees in motion intersecting with cars in motion. In my head, it doesn't make sense, but it does happen, and it happens all the time.
So with regard to these tree falling cases in every jurisdiction, there are three elements that you have to prove. Now, most of the cases don't even mention the first element. It's really implied that the tortfeasor, the person that you're trying to recover damages from, actually owned the tree or had some sort of duty of care with regard to the tree. Two, that the tree itself was in a dangerous condition or otherwise constituted a danger. And three, that the owner of the land knew or should have known that the tree was in a dangerous condition, so they had actual or constructive notice of the tree being diseased or defective.
So basically what we're talking about, it is negligence principles.
So let's start with the first prong, the one that's sort of implied, whether or not the person that you're going after actually owned the tree or had some sort of duty with regard to the tree. Because I think this is a place where we often get hung up on these cases.
And it is a threshold issue. If the tree actually doesn't belong to the defendant that you've brought to court, they are off scot-free and you are left holding the bag, and you have to find the person who actually owns the tree. And for a plaintiff, the last thing you want to find out is that the tree actually belongs to you. So
or to your insured.
Or to your insured. Should you take the case to litigation, you have experts come in, a land surveyor, and kind of place the tree where it was before it fell. You want that tree to be on someone else's land than yours. That should be a given.
And 2 years after the incident occurred is often much too late to even prove this point. This is something that has to be done early, that there needs to be some sort of inspection or some sort of agreement by the two parties about who actually owned the tree. Because often what we're talking about are trees that sit right on the property line. And so there is going to be some question about who actually owned that tree that fell.
If it's understood that the tree belongs to the defendant, you know, all the better for you. But in my experience in these cases, nothing is stipulated as far as who owns the tree and who has duties as to which part of the tree and things like that.
So in order to prove who owned the tree, what are some things that the clients can do? What are some things that attorneys can do in order to meet this threshold issue?
Well, if you're not going to get a stipulation as to ownership of the tree, you can have a land surveyor come out and actually place the tree on one property or the other. You want to do that early in the process, because as years go by, you're going to find that no one can agree where the tree actually stood before if there's nothing left of it. So if they can come out, take the measurements, look at the way the lands are plotted out, they can definitively place the tree on one property or another. And that generally will run you several hundred dollars, if not $1,000.
And it's important to remember that 2 years later is going to be too late. You're going to have overgrowth and then disagreement over, like you said, where the tree actually stood. Mm-hmm. So this is something that needs to happen early on in the process.
Not to mention, if you find out the tree doesn't belong to the person you think it does, now your statute's blown. You can't add the person mm-hmm. who the tree actually belonged to. So you're in an even worse position.
Exactly. So the second element is, did the tree actually constitute a danger? Was it in a diseased or defective condition? And this becomes an issue when there are storms and things or some sort of act of God type defense, right?
Mm-hmm. The signs of danger before the tree falls that are going to put a reasonable landowner on notice that they've got a dangerous condition that they need to take care of are that there could be obviously brown or rotted bark or leaves out of season. If you have the tree turns autumn colors way too early, if there's cracked or exposed bark, not only is that a sign of your tree in trouble already, but it can actually accelerate the decay of the tree because it invites parasites and disease. And one I didn't think of was any tree that has multiple trunks. If you have a tree that has two main branches, two giant trunks, and they're in either a V or a U shape, the bigger that tree gets, the more likely it is to split right down the middle. And the tree might be healthy at, you know, from 1 year and then be super risky the next year. And also any trees that lean one way or the other, most trees aren't straight up and down, but if it leans excessively, I would say, or if you have exposed roots on one side or cracked or mounding soil on one side and not the other, you can tell that the tree is leaning more and more, and the cracks in the mounding soil are going to be on the opposite side of the lean. And this is a sign that your tree could come down, and you want to take steps to either remove the tree or otherwise get it straightened if it's not too late for that.
And this is important because if you have a case where the tree comes down during a windstorm or a rainstorm or gets hit by lightning, and there wasn't some other sort of evidence or outward appearance of the tree being diseased, then you're not going to be able to prove that the tree was in a dangerous condition. In other words, landowners are not going to be held liable for otherwise healthy trees that get struck by lightning.
Correct.
So this leads then to the third element, and I think that this third element is where most of the legal battles occur, and that's, did the owner of the land know, or should they have known, that the tree was in a dangerous condition? Was there some sort of actual or constructive notice to the landowner of this defective condition?
I think we should take a second to say what the Restatement of Torts says about the duties of a landowner on their property. The general rule is that a person can use the land as they see fit, and that so long as they're not invading the rights of others, the possessor of land, or neither a possessor of land nor a vendor, lessor, or other transferor, is liable for physical harm caused to others outside of the land by the natural condition of the land. And what that means is, you know, a tree is a natural condition, I would think, just as you know, any kind of hills or rocky outcrops or anything that could otherwise be dangerous to a person, if it's the natural condition of the land and it's not artificial, the owner of the land is not going to be liable for that. However, if the owner of the land abutting a highway or adjacent to another property, they can be held liable on negligence principles under certain circumstances, and those are the circumstances that we're going to get into.
Even on their own property, they can be held liable depending on the type of property they have. So Prosser, our friend Prosser on torts, drew a distinction that is recognized in many states between rural lands and urban lands. And the idea is that rural landowners, they have a lot of trees. These trees may or may not abut the highway, who knows, big properties. They don't actually have any duty to inspect every tree on the property. So even if a tree does have some sort of visible defect, you would have to prove that that rural landowner had actual knowledge of that defect, that they at some point saw it and acknowledged that they saw it, even if those trees are near a public highway. Now, if you are able to prove that that rural landowner did have actual knowledge of the defect, then that landowner does have to take affirmative steps in order to take down the tree or to otherwise make it safe, lest they be held liable. Now, you contrast that with the urban landowners. Urban landowners, who presumably have fewer trees on their property, do have more of a duty to inspect their trees, especially if they're abutting roadways and things like that.
Fewer trees and more people, so you have a greater opportunity to have a look at your trees, and there's a greater likelihood that if the tree falls, it's going to damage someone else. So the public at large is having a little bit more risk than in the rural situation.
So under Prosser's rule, which has been adopted by several states, including, for example, Maryland, the rural landowner is only liable if you can prove actual notice, whereas an urban landowner is going to be liable based on actual or constructive notice of the defective nature of the tree. And then he also notes, and the Maryland courts have noted, this gray area in between, which they call the suburban forest, somewhere between the rural and the urban lands, because suburban areas, as we know, like green space, the different municipalities like to encourage people to keep the trees up and to keep lots of good green space that's good for everybody. But it can mean that there are a lot more trees to inspect, even though you may not be in a strictly urban setting.
So what are some of the ways that you can prove actual notice to a rural landowner? The only way I've ever seen it happen in my personal experience is where there is a dangerous looking tree. Obviously the tree is dead, and you have a neighbor who notices it, gets a little skittish about it, and writes a letter. Mm-hmm. Then you have a record in writing, and you can say, you know, with a date on it, you can say, look, I informed you in September of 2015 that this tree looked dead. You know, August of the next year, the tree fell and knocked my entire barn down. That's actual notice. You can also get there with testimony to say, you know, we talked about the tree several times. That would be actual notice as well. It's going to be a little hard to prove if you get into questions of, you know, one side says they told the other side about the tree and the other side says, no, that conversation didn't happen. Then it's up to the finder of fact who they believe. I've also seen it, and I'll mention this case again later. I had a case where the landowner had a judgment against them, and part of the judgment was to remove a tree. So that you couldn't get more actual notice than that. A judge said, take the tree down. They didn't take the tree down. That's actual notice.
Absolutely. And then in other situations, if we're talking about urban areas or even suburban areas where there is liability on the basis of constructive notice, courts have been careful to point out that it's not that a landowner has a duty to constantly and consistently check all of their trees for non-visible decay. Instead, the decay has to be readily observable by a layperson. So, for example, there's a case out of New York State where the plaintiff hired an expert. So the plaintiff is a neighbor who gets injured by this tree, and they hire an expert, and the expert is able to look at the limbs, and they can see in the stump that there is a limb hole, where I guess there was a limb that had subsequently died, and that limb hole allowed water to get into the stump and allowed rot to occur within the tree, and that therefore that tree was in a decaying state. But what the court found was that a layperson is not a tree expert. A layperson is not an arborist. And so therefore, there was not a responsibility on the part of the landowner to recognize that this was a problem. Trees have holes in them.
Right.
But unless the decay is recognizable by a layperson, you may find that even if there is visible decay, the court is reticent to attach liability.
So you probably won't see liability on cases where there is some green on the tree, some leaves at the top, and some decay on the bottom. A court in that circumstance is going to say, you know, it's up in the air whether or not a layperson would have found that tree to be dangerous.
Well,
if it's a fully dead tree, I think anyone can tell an absolutely dead tree with limbs falling off of it, no leaves for several seasons, from a tree that's alive and is doing just fine.
And it's going to be a question of fact. So mm-hmm. In the New York case, The court found that even though the defendant landowner testified that she had not inspected the tree for over 10 years, because there was no visible indicia of decay, or indicia, excuse me, of decay or disease to a layperson, that she wouldn't be liable. But there are other courts that have found the opposite, that there is a duty to inspect every few years, especially if there's some question about the status of the tree. So for your own personal use, or at least the way that I think about my own property, is I want to lay eyeballs on those trees periodically. And like you say, I want to see that there's new growth on them from season to season. I want to see that kind of thing, but know that this is going to be an issue of fact that probably has to be proven at trial.
This is where we're going to get into constructive notice, because if you take no effort to inspect your trees, and in fact later on you can't say, I didn't know there were any, you know, dying or decaying trees on my property, and the only reason for that is that you never looked at them. You can't rely on the fact that you didn't have notice, when anyone who owned that property should have known through any kind of reasonable inspection that you have a dangerous tree.
Right. As long as the danger is readily apparent to a layperson. Exactly. So we've talked a lot about private landowners, but as we mentioned, these cases take many forms. It's not just a tree falling from one property onto an adjoining property. Sometimes it's a tree that falls onto a roadway and I think spectacularly manages to hit a car, which happens more often than we think it does. And in those situations, you may be going after a state entity or a municipality who governs the roadway.
In Ohio, the courts have found that the Department of Transportation does have a duty to keep the roads in a safe, drivable condition. However, that applies only to roads and road hazards and does not necessarily always cover trees and limbs. The Department of Transportation merely has to exercise due care and diligence in proper maintenance and repair of the highways. Again, the trees aren't mentioned in those holdings. So the duty of care of a Department of Transportation, it does encompass a duty to remove dangerous conditions which present a known risk to the public. And if those dangerous conditions include trees in Ohio, then the Department of Transportation can be held liable.
So this is one of those situations where it's very apparent that these are very fact-specific cases, and there's a lot of court interpretation that is involved here. So even in the state of Ohio, for example, we have some counties that find that the municipality or the Department of Transportation may be liable for trees that fall onto the roadway. They may be liable for the maintenance of trees that abut roadways, whereas Hamilton County, which is the county where we are, actually has specifically found that the statute that requires the municipality to maintain the roads specifically exempts trees, does not apply to the maintenance of trees. And then on the other side, there is a court of claims case in Ohio, which did find that the Department of Transportation was liable for failing to maintain the trees. So it's going to depend specifically on the court and maybe even which judge you get. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, too, it's interesting to note that the Court of Claims in Ohio is a special venue where you have to bring claims against the state of Ohio. You can't bring those within a regular state court in Ohio, and Court of Claims actually specifically bars claims for subrogation. You cannot bring a subrogation claim in the Court of Claims. So your insured can bring a claim for their damages, but anything that has already been paid for by an insurance company can't be heard there. So, you know, even though we've got a Court of Claims case that says the Department of Transportation bears liability for maintaining the trees, that will probably not translate to a subrogation recovery.
Insurance companies bear the risk for those trees.
In Ohio.
What about states in such as Kentucky, where there is sovereign immunity? The government has immunity from most, if not all, of its ministerial acts, unless it has waived that immunity.
Well, and to be clear, every single state in the country has sovereign immunity unless they have specifically waived it. So many states throughout the country do make the distinction with regard to sovereign immunity on discretionary versus ministerial acts.
So what determines whether it's a discretionary or a ministerial act? In Kentucky, it is basically whether the acts involve policy-making decisions or significant judgment, or if there is a statute or other regulation that compels the state to take an act, or is it merely just a routine duty of the state? So in the context of trees, is there a statute or a regulation that imposes a duty on the state to actually go around and inspect trees and remove them? Or is it just a routine duty of the state to take a tree down where it sees a dangerous condition and then not otherwise have a position or a government entity that goes out and looks for dangerous or dying trees? So you have to determine whether or not the acts are ministerial or discretionary for the purposes of determining whether or not the state is going to waive immunity or not waive immunity. And the difference between discretionary and ministerial acts are whether or not there is a statute or regulation that compels the state to act, or whether or not it involves policy-making decisions or significant judgment is the language that is used, or whether or not it's just a routine duty of the state.
So if there's a policy-making decision, so a statute that specifically says that the state has a duty to do something, then that is a discretionary act.
Correct. Like if a state had a certain person, like a tree warden, who is in charge of doing tree maintenance and that is his job, that would be seen as a ministerial duty. And for those acts, the state is waiving immunity in most cases.
But then if it's not something that's specifically legislated for, there's not a stated duty there, then that would be considered a discretionary act, and there may be sovereign immunity that applies to bar any sort of claim for liability against the state.
Correct, such as in the cases where you have a Department of Transportation who is doing road cleanup during the road cleanup, or just an inspection to make sure that there are no dangerous conditions to a motoring public. They're going around looking for potholes and things. If they see a tree or a tree limb in the road and they remove it, these are routine duties. They don't include a statute to force the state to do that, and therefore the state could claim immunity, in which case anyone damaged by that tree is not able to recover against the state.
Then there's one other way where even if you do a great job of proving your entire case, you've got an owner who knew or should have known about the defective nature of the tree. You have a tree that was in fact defective and you proved that the owner was the owner. You can still lose. And that is, and I was just amazed to see this case, and that is with an assumption of risk defense. There's a great case out of Louisiana, and it is from 1987, Thibodeau versus Moraine. And side note, the only reason I know how to pronounce Thibodeau is because of an episode of King of the Hill, where a character by Matthew McConaughey from Louisiana calls himself a Thibodeaux and is corrected on his own name. Isn't that pronounced Thibodeau? So... Anyway, in Thibodeau versus Moraine, the Louisiana Court of Appeals found that the owner of the tree was the owner of the tree, did in fact know or should have known that the tree was defective. These were visibly rotting and decaying trees, and there were many of them. So he knew about it, and he owned it, and they were defective. And the action was brought by his lessor. So the person who rented the property from him had parked his car under these trees, and then the trees had subsequently fallen onto this car. So here is the problem. The court found that the plaintiff, the renter who was injured, assumed the risk because the renter could also see that the trees were dying and decaying, and so he shouldn't have parked his car underneath them, especially in a rainstorm.
These trees were so dead
that literally anyone could see that they were dying.
So if your tree, you go from a certain place where your tree is doing fine, you're okay. If it's a little bit diseased, you may be in trouble. If it's very, very diseased, then anyone who gets near it assumes the risk. according to this case. Anyway.
Well, in the different and the interesting thing in this case, or the fact that will set it apart from most cases, is the relationship between the parties. Right. This isn't somebody who is just driving under this tree once. This is the renter who has lived at this property for an extended period of time and knowingly parked his car under visibly decaying trees.
Presumably has an ongoing relationship with this tree.
With the trees.
He sees the tree every day. He's familiar with the tree and its many moods.
Well, in fact, he actually admitted, and this is Thibodeau, admitted at trial that he intended to stop under the trees only briefly because he was aware of the likelihood that the branches would fall on his car.
So he's just unlucky as well.
Well.
He was there briefly.
Or stupid.
He was there briefly, and what he thought might happen, in fact, it happened.
That's right. That's right. So that was unreasonable, and the court found that even though there would be liability on the part of the defendant, that the defendant could actually assert an assumption of risk defense against the plaintiff to say, no, you assumed the risk. And the court held it up, at least in Louisiana.
So assumption of risk can be a defense. We've talked about the best defense is, hey, that's not even my tree. That one should work at any time. And then what other defenses do we have? We have the defense, the act of God, or I believe it's force majeure. Mm-hmm. Is that how you say that? Because I only ever read it. I don't say it if I can help it.
Well, that's one act of those depends on where you are.
Act of God, I could say those are three-letter words. Let's see. The act of God term and its legal significance means any irresistible disaster, result of natural causes such as earthquakes, violent storms, lightning, or unprecedented floods. So if it's a precedented flood, you actually might not make it.
Well, that's if you live in a floodplain.
Mm-hmm. Or if you may have to draw a distinction between a violent storm and just a storm.
Right.
A tree that is otherwise healthy may not be expected to survive a violent storm, or all of the tree anyway, but a tree that is otherwise dangerous might come down in a regular storm.
Exactly, and so that's when you have to go back and look at the history, the historical weather data and almanacs and things like that to determine, were these winds of a speed and a force that is standard for the area? Because sometimes you can use that information to actually prove whether or not the tree was in a defective condition.
And I've had that happen in cases I've handled many times. It was with these tree cases is you got to go back and you find the historical record of what the winds are like in the area generally and what they were on the date that this actually happened, and kind of compare the two. Is this something that is out of the ordinary for the area, and can you expect a tree to survive? And it's, you know, as with everything else with tree cases, it's fact-based.
All of it is fact-based, and it's always a judgment call that you're asking the court to make. None of these are going to be 100% winners.
Mm-hmm. So with the act of God defense, the act of God has to be so unusual and overwhelming that it would do damage on its own power without reference to or independent of any negligence by the defendant. So then there's no liability. So you actually could have a tree that is dead and then have an act of God come around and cause the tree to fall and injure property. The defendant still would not be liable because the act of God is what caused the damage. If a tree is uprooted by a tornado, let's say, and causes damage to a neighboring property, it can be shown that the tree was left up and that constitutes negligence. However, the negligence wasn't tied to the damage. The damage was done by the act of God itself.
So the act of God there breaks the proximate cause between the defective nature, the defective condition of the tree, and the resulting damage.
Exactly.
But it's a high standard there for act of God, and I think that people tend to forget that this isn't just a regular storm. This is something out of the ordinary that can cause damage on its own, like as you mentioned, a tornado, lightning strike, things like that.
I've had a lot of adjusters send me the argument that, you know, it was really windy that day. and my argument always is, you know, it's windy a lot of days. If it's every time it's windy, you have to watch out for flying trees, then...
Then we're all in trouble.
We're in some bad shape.
So, Steve, do any of these tree falling cases that you've handled stick out in your mind?
I can definitely tell you about my least favorite one, and that is the the ones that that go wrong despite everything going right at the beginning. I had a case where we actually had a judgment against the defendant in our case. The judgment was from a year prior. The insured had actually taken him to court because a limb had fallen from the tree and hit part of the property and caused some damage. So the insured on his own took the defendant to court. The judge ruled that the defendant pay for the damage and take down the tree. So that was both parts of the same judgment. A year later, the entire tree falls and hits the insured's porch and the roof and damages some wrought iron fencing and just causes a lot more damage this time. This time he turns it into his insurance company, and of course now I'm involved.
Our insured turned it into his insurance company.
Absolutely. So we come along, we file suit against the defendant. Lo and behold, we have a judgment against the defendant from a year prior saying, you have to take this tree down. It's a dangerous tree. So slam dunk case, right?
You've got all the notice in the world.
It's actual notice from a judge. We're going to take this judgment, and I'm thinking I can file a summary judgment motion. That's it. I'm all set. Well, it turns out that even in cases like this where you have actual notice and, you know, obviously dangerous tree, it's already fallen, parts of it have fallen once before. I've got an open and shut case, right? What is actually the case is that the defendant tried to take the tree down, realizes that you can't take the tree down because there are power lines from the local utility company sort of all the way around the tree, intermixed with all the limbs of the tree. So the power company would have to come out and actually move some of their power lines before the tree could come down. Fine, power companies can do that. Turns out the insured has to agree to have the power lines moved, because part of the power lines to move them have to run now over and through the insured's property. And the insured didn't allow the power company to move the lines. So everyone was basically stuck. The defendant made a good faith effort to move the lines, and the insured, for whatever reason, prevented that from happening. Fast forward to when I'm involved, the tree comes down, and the defendant tried to comply with the judgment, the insured made sure that didn't happen, and here we are.
So your insured snatched defeat from the jaws of victory on that one.
That's basically the gist of it. We did settle the case, but it wasn't the open and shut slam dunk case that I expected it to be when it first came across my desk.
Well, aside from that case, in most of these tree falling cases, to review, we want to make sure that we can prove all three of our elements. First, you want early proof that the tortfeasor actually owned the tree. So get the surveys you need or get acquiescence from the tortfeasor or something that they actually owned the tree. Second, you need information that the tree actually constituted a danger. The tree was somehow defective, diseased, or was going to come down on its own.
And if you don't have that from before the accident or before the tree falls down, you can always get it at the scene before everything's cleaned up. You can take pictures of the downed tree or downed limbs. Usually adjusters are pretty good about this, taking pictures of the scene in at every angle and getting in close to the tree so that later on, you can examine it to see what the condition of the tree was on the date that it fell.
Absolutely. And then finally, the most important part is the notice piece, that the owner of the tree knew or should have known that the tree was in a dangerous condition. So obviously, if you in your regular life see a tree that's near your property and you think that it's in danger of falling down, you should contact the property owner in writing or via email to let them know that you think that the tree should be looked at. Same thing goes for your insureds, and if they do that, then you will have a pretty slick tree falling case. Well, anything else on trees falling, Steve?
Nothing from me.
If you have any questions about trees falling or any other topic, feel free to reach out to us at podcast@rathbonegroup.com.
Or you can visit us at our website, rathbonegroup.com.
Until next time, I'm Rebecca Wright.
And I'm Steve Elson.
And this has been Rathbone Group on Subrogation.